Okay, I hope you could hear me now. The title is The Preparation of the Elements for the Great Fire, which is one of the pastor's main sections in the volume. And it is one that concerns the brethren in these this day and age, because we see such a turmoil in the earth, and we see how the nations are progressively being prepared for the great fire, kind of illustrated by our picture here, that's going to conclude it. Going to conclude this age. The nations are now economically, and this is very important, quite dependent upon each other. This is why things didn't happen earlier, because it requires a dependence, so things fall like a dominoes down the line. And this is part of the Lord's design, that at the same time, they all will experience the result of their selfishness, a great time of trouble. Very efficient here. Pastor Russell could certainly see a great degree of the gathering of the nations and the preparation of the elements. Somebody has their audio mic on. Along with the outrage of the people. But this conflict can be seen to be even more precarious today. Imagine, you know, how he felt. It was coming up to World War I. Well, this is kind of like how we're, I think, the same kind of degree that we feel today. So we want to examine again very thoroughly, very logically, and see the progression of the observations and expectations and how they apply in our day. It's a little different than in the pastor's day. It's got some similarities, but some differences. Specifically, the role of the modern day giants, and that grouping has expanded and changed a little bit, as one of those elements already in preparation for the great fire. So at the appointed time when Jehovah will say enough, we will see the conclusion of Zephaniah's prophecy. Remember this famous prophecy in Zephaniah 3:8, "Wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy." Selfishness being the universal provocation for gathering the greedy leaders of government, industry, and religion, we'll see all of these delivered into the hands of those crying for justice. Because the common people see only the only path that they have for any kind of relief is revolution. They've tried asking nicely, and it doesn't work. This would all be very troubling to us right now, especially, except we know that God is the great commander who now gathers the nations and assembles the kingdoms. And his purpose is transferring earth's dominion to him whose right it is. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. Psalms 46:2-3 is a prophecy for our time of the hope we must maintain, even though we see catastrophic destruction of the systems now in power. So as we read this, replace the symbolic words with the prophetic meanings. Earth would be society. Mountains would be the kingdoms, and the sea would be the ungovernable masses of people. This is just as Luke prophesied in chapter 17, verse 26. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. Well, this leads us to compare the conditions of Noah's day, obviously, to the time of the second presence of our Lord. As the pastor compared the conditions, he pointed out one of the key elements corresponding to that of Noah's day. There were giants in the earth of those days, mighty men which were of old, men of renown, Genesis 6:4. And of course, this tells us that previous to the end of the first dispensation, a superhuman influence had entered the world, and power from an angelic source had produced very undesirable conditions to the extent of bringing into existence an unauthorized race who were powerful, self-serving giants. Well, the pastor's supposition was that in the last days, now, there would be a counterpart of the giants, as there was in the days of Noah, even if not specifically mentioned by Luke. And the pastor rightly pointed to certain giant monopolistic companies in his era, as a corresponding element to the giants of Noah's day. Those giant monopolies or trusts of the pastor's day tightly controlled the cost of goods and services, and they crowded out competition in a very forceful way. They imposed on the people no real options or choices for the goods the people needed. So like the Nephilim of Noah's day, these modern giants were simply overbearing bullies, which defied attempts by trade unions and regulatory agencies to moderate their unfair practices and employee treatment. Well, this kind of behavior suggests an evil spirit is behind it, an evil influence on the hearts and minds of those men in power. So we look at Ephesians 6:12. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. The pastor also points out how the individuals who formed these tyrannical monopolies first received enlightenment and advantage because of being in a civilized society based upon Christian principles and Christian wisdom. How deplorable it is that they would misuse that advantage in such a selfish way. But the behavior really fits the picture of the Nephilim in Noah's time, a hybrid product of the far superior angels mixing with mere humans, corresponding to today's hybrid giants being begotten by Christian enlightenment acting in combination with the selfish hearts of fallen men. It's interesting to note the pastor's words in the 1916 foreword to volume 4, 20 years after the volume was first written. He says, although the trusts at the time of the writing of this were beneficial rather than injurious. Now that's interesting. The trust started out to be beneficial rather than injurious. Nevertheless, he continues, these giants born of avarice and built up in self-interest would eventually become a menace, a danger to the people and their interests. We have reached that time, and many are realizing the danger is upon us. That's the end of the quote. Examples now in the 1800s of big trusts were especially the steel and rail industries ruled by Rockefeller and Carnegie and the banking systems owned by J.P. Morgan. These modern giants in the pastor's day were a real menace and threat to the nation, similar to the literal giants that threatened the world with violence in Noah's day. As the Nephilim could not be controlled by mere humans in Noah's day, we are assured that it will take really divine intervention to fully remove these powerful and cunning modern corporate giants. So let's look at a specific incident that illustrates this point. So I'm going to pick out the 1892 strike. This was in America. It was the Homestead Steel Strike. And I'm citing this example as a kind of provocation that will bring about an uncontainable uprising in the future by the Lord's great army. Located just across the river from the Carnegie-Pittsburgh steel plant was a scene of a brutal battle between the Iron and Steel Workers Union of Carnegie's Pittsburgh Steel, which wanted to break the union's power and punish union members. Well, Pittsburgh Steel announced pay cuts, refused to negotiate with the union, locked workers out of the plant, and then sent private police to bully the union strikers. The whole thing became a bloody gunfight, along with the use of the Pennsylvania state militia. The workers' union was crushed. This all showed how hard it was to overcome a giant, a strong company that prospered under the lack of government regulation or any kind of meaningful enforcement. Well, another example of the influence of corporate giants was the Great Steel Strike in 1919. During World War I, industrial companies, labor unions, and the U.S. government joined together to form the War Labor Board, an organization that brokered a deal to stave off strikes in exchange for improved labor conditions. Sounds good, right? Well, a consortium of unions that included the American Federation of Labor and the Iron, Steel, and Tin Workers Union called for the strike of the workers at U.S. Steel, the nation's biggest employer at that time, and one that refused to recognize unions. They just refused unions altogether. Well, 35,000 workers walked off the job in six states, while the strike temporarily paralyzed steel production. It was eventually crushed. Again, police and company hired thugs beat up picketers. And again, the workers and unions suffered a great defeat and a big setback for the labor movement. It looked like labor was never going to get ahead. Yes, monopolies and trusts were prevalent in the pastor's day. And it has been assumed that a great revolution leading to global anarchy was imminent by 1914. But by the early 1900s, there were signs that it would be necessary to adjust the assumption of the original time frame. Okay, let me explain that, this adjustment. This is something the pastor probably thought about, but he didn't see it realized. We want to note that by the early 1900s, laws and other restrictive measures to prevent monopolies were forming, including labor unions and antitrust laws. As far back as 1890, there was a Sherman Antitrust Act, which made monopolies and trusts illegal, but it wasn't enforced very well. And then in the early 1900s, President Theodore Roosevelt empowered several federal regulatory commissions to tear down the big monopolistic trusts. This was a big feature of his presidency. And then comes along in 1912, Woodrow Wilson, whose campaign speech, and this is kind of remarkable, actually referred to the phrase, quote, "There were giants in those days," end of quote. And then he stated, "America was created to break every kind of monopoly and to set men free upon a footing of equality, upon a footing of opportunity to match their brains and energies." I kind of like him. It sounds like a very idealistic and principled person. And then in 1914, the Clayton Antitrust Act expanded the Sherman Act by prohibiting price discrimination. Well, new consumer welfare standards were adopted. Now we're jumping way up into the 1970s. And as late as 2021, an executive order by the President of the United States established a White House competition council to combat activities and cultivate greater competition in the marketplace. You know, in fact, in 2021, I mean, that's not that long ago, six antitrust bills were passed, which were designed to closely examine whether big tech mergers, big tech company mergers, would stifle competition. Little companies were worried about this. So Congress admits that in their assessment, not all mergers are bad. Let me repeat that. So there's an admission that not all mergers are bad for the public, and some large corporations have demonstrated that they are socially responsible. Yes, many large corporations today do attempt to take selfish advantage of the public by trying to take control of the marketplace. But government regulations and trade unions of this time period today have demonstrated to be partially effective in limiting the unfair behavior of the large companies. This then resulted in temporarily satisfying the cries for justice, thus averting an uprising of the Lord's great army. Now, know what I'm not saying. I'm not saying anything stops. It just is a temporary measure, and obviously selfishness will undo it all. So it's interesting that Brother Russell in the year 1916 was speculating about Elijah's mantle, and the smiting of the Jordan River was still waiting for the point when he could conclusively identify the antitype of that series of events. He could certainly see a great degree of the gathering of the nations and the preparation of the elements, along with the outrage of the people, but what was the antitype of the actual smiting of the waters? Were all the pieces of this impending event fully in place so that some incident and truth message could compel the people to an unstoppable revolutionary uprising? I am not saying we should change the idea of big business being the giants, but today these giants are not as easily identified as the monopolies and trusts of the past. Repeating, most big businesses seem only to be restrained because there are regulations. They're not doing this voluntarily and benevolently cooperating with for public good. And their power in politics, government, and social media is ever increasing. For example, in 2021, Congress set laws in place to force the CEOs of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google to be more transparent in business practices. This all sounds somewhat positive, but in actuality, the government regulators admit getting bogged down in technicalities, definitions of terms, and resistance to cooperate on the part of those giant companies. I mean, these companies are not going to just say, oh, that sounds good to us. So, in other words, the selfish modern giants in industry have not really gone away, but they defy control and are now learning how to work around the regulations. So let me repeat, the modern giants of industry with fancy lawyers find ways to endlessly delay or pretty much altogether avert government regulations and control. And in addition to working around regulations, let's review a real example of how big business today can stifle competition and get around some of the anti-monopoly regulations. This is kind of an interesting and very devious example. In 2009, Amazon launched a price war against a competitor called diapers.com, something over which Amazon was willing to lose $200 million on their own diaper sales in a single month, with the ultimate goal to force the smaller competitor to sell out to Amazon. So Amazon might say, so what's wrong with that? We're just being competitive. What an attitude. Herein we can see the dispute between the corporate versus the regulatory agency perspective. The original intention of government agencies, and you see many of them sitting there on the screen right now, was for consumer welfare. And the various laws were to keep companies from unfair business practices. But from the selfish position of the giants, it is simply fair competition. Whole different perspective. Well, other modern day giants can be found in the social media industry that has kind of a reputation of sacrificing truth and public safety for profit. Monopolistic pharmaceutical companies, another one, are also infamous for extracting huge profits while ignoring the welfare of the needy. And the entertainment companies, movies and television and so forth, which have fewer consumer controls, no seeming moral boundaries, and fill people's minds with unhealthy and unrighteous thoughts. In addition, military contractors greatly overcharging for their services because of their monopolistic grip. So the point is that many corporations still disregard the public good and are not only interested and are only interested in big profits. And that often means finding ways to circumvent government regulations or using really kind of pressure tactics using lobbyists for what is essentially a bribery to the influence the government officials to vote in a way that would not harm the corporation's interests. It's important to emphasize again that government regulations and trade union negotiations seem to somewhat satisfy the cries for justice for now, but this will only delay the simply or the still impending anarchy of the Lord's discontented and restless masses, the Lord's great army. The people can only be told the lie for so long. In addition to big business, another kind of giant has arisen in the financial sector. Bankers, stock market speculators, hedge fund operators, and so forth. Well, this new kind of giant, unlike the giants of the earlier years, you know, they're really producing nothing, contributing nothing to the society as a whole. They don't make steel. They don't construct buildings. They don't weave cloth. They don't run grocery stores. They just manipulate the financial systems, lending money, borrowing money, investing in profitable businesses, not to the benefit of the general public, but simply to benefit themselves, or more accurately stated, their rich owners or stockholders. For instance, when the national economy and the job situation was poor, you know, back in the time of the COVID, there was an epidemic, and the government in the U.S. as well as other countries, you know, tried to ease the pain to the general public and stimulate jobs by pumping hundreds of billions of dollars into the financial sector. Okay, so this was their idea. The government essentially loaned the banks at nearly 0% money rate with the idea, the theory, that the banks would in turn, they were instructed to in turn, offer new low interest loans to the public for low interest home mortgages and low interest loans to small businesses to stimulate the economy. Great idea. But the flaw is nobody said they had to do this. They were just told that they would like to encourage them to do this. So what happens? Instead of the money trickling down to the small business sector and to the people, the financial institutions instead decided that they could make more money quicker by just investing that government money that they were given in the same government bonds the Fed was buying. What? So it wasn't going out to the people at all. It was just being plowed back into buying bonds. In other words, it would be sort of like if somebody gave you money and you were supposed to distribute it among the brethren, and you said, no, I'm going to go invest it in a CD, and then I'm just going to make money off the CD. And that's basically what they were doing. They knew that with the government setting new low interest rates, the market rate of government bonds would go up. It was a sure thing, a sure way to profit.
So she said, can you walk like that? And he thought she was going to ask it. Yeah, ma'am.
Thank you. So former Federal Reserve official Andrew Huszar kind of stated it this way.
The Fed's idea was the banks would be taking that money and lending it effectively at lower interest rates. What the banks were doing instead was that they were just investing in the same bonds that the Fed was buying. Just because the Fed wanted to do something and wanted to help the average American, it doesn't necessarily mean that Wall Street has the same interest.
Washington loaned them money at cut rates, so our thanks is they're going to stuff it in their pockets, even as many Americans are suffering from unemployment and reduced wages.
People absolutely ought to be outraged.
The Federal Reserve money was to be the blood supply for the economy. It was supposed to be a good thing, but instead of the banking system being that lifeline, they were simply the blood suckers. The conclusion is that this new giant in the banking financial sector is also born of selfishness. Yes, as we just heard in the interview, people absolutely ought to be outraged. And we see this theme will continue until all the corrupt systems are eventually exposed and torn down. So as we alluded to earlier, the Nephilim giants were a hybrid, remember, of those two natures, spiritual and earthly. Well, this suggests an additional modern day entity that shares that label of giant, a new kind. Mystic Babylon is a hybrid, remember. It's a hybrid of the nominal spiritual heavens mixed with what? The world and the earthly governments. Take a look at Revelation 18, verse 9, and the prophetic outcome predicted in the pastor's comments. This is from volume 3, Thy Kingdom Come, in the 1916 forward, page 4. Quote, and the kings, the political element of the earth, that's society, who have committed fornication, that's illegitimately associating with her, shall bewail her and lament for her when they see the smoke, that's the evidence of her burning, Babylon's destruction. So we see that the kings of the past became corrupt by their association with the elements of that harlot, creating that unlawful hybrid of nominal Christianity and state, and therefore imposing on the people no choice for the spiritual goods they require. No freedom of religion, no choice but the brand of beliefs that the church states, nations sanctioned. But we haven't seen such a rigid Christian church-controlled government since the end of World War I. So could this really happen again? Well, the desire among many Christian groups is that it certainly should happen. In 2022, during a political rally for the office of governor in the city of Atlanta, proponents of what is called the Christian nationalism chanted, let's see, where's my note here? We, the church, are God's governing body on the earth. We, the church, are God's governing body on the earth, and we have been given a legal power from heaven and now exercise our authority.
A divine mandate to change the country in accordance with the biblical values that these folks claim to have.
We believe it's time to release the roar of Christian voters across America.
So, even though history has shown that there are a lot of dire consequences to personal freedoms connected with totalitarian governments, you know, a national pride and the desire for a national identity, and especially an ethnic or religious identity, outweighs these consequences. It's very interesting, this desire for nationalism and a religious nationalism. A memorable example in the Bible history is that found in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Now here, according to the Lord's directive first of all, in 1 Samuel 8:19, Samuel originally set up a unique government over Israel that would ensure fairness for all, appointing judges over Israel. But because the people wanted that feeling of nationalistic pride that they saw in other countries, they petitioned the Lord to replace the judges with a king. Samuel gave God's warning to the elders of the Israel that kings, you know, with total control could be oppressive and that they would surely regret their request. Nevertheless, the people said, "Nay, but we will have a king over us." Even back then, citing the need for a strong leader to more effectively ensure national security. National security, national security. A more or less modern day extreme example was starting in Italy in 1922, Benito Mussolini and his fascist party, which advocated government control of labor, industry, the press, everything. And Italy really felt humiliated and wanted this because they felt cheated by the post-World War I treaty imposed by the British. And Mussolini's promise then to the people of Italy was he was going to bring back Italy into its former greatness. Well, later, in the wake of World War I, arose another parallel situation in Germany. Adolf Hitler, after seeing the humiliation and oppression of his homeland in the post-war period, vowed to make Germany great again. You can see a pattern here. He set about to organize the Nazi Party and used many oppressive tactics to spread only the news that the party wanted the people to hear. Well, Hitler knew his success would be in telling people what to think and what to believe, and then what to do. Both the Italian and the German people supported leaders like these that promised that their nations would come into world prominence and respect. Later in the wake of World War I arose, So jumping to 1989, after the fall of the USSR, Vladimir Putin comes to the scene and promised the Russian people that he would restore prominence and respect for Russia. And now today we see even more propaganda and misinformation to confuse the people and cover up the government's failings. But don't think that these deceitful methods are only being used in Russia and China. No, even political parties in the United States are using these same kind of tactics and propaganda to their great advantage. Well, how? Maybe this could happen, but if it was to happen, if these things were to happen, this predominance of nationalism, Christian nationalism, how would it happen? Well, the predominantly Christian nations, including the United States, are already, what? They're fearful of Islam. Christian nationalists and other evangelicals push the idea that Islam as a real threat to their way of life, and they point to the massive immigration of Muslims in Europe that has already altered the social fabric and is causing conflict. Islamic encroachment will most likely provoke Europe to their past intolerance of other religions. And we already see the far right political parties gaining popularity, especially in Germany right now. At some point, if the European or Western nations become desperately fearful of the Islamic threat and also fearful of the collapse under the impending violent outcry of the people, got two things here, not just of Islam, but of their own people, for this kind of social justice and economic justice on these many issues, then governments will seek means to put a lid on the problems and to quell the uprisings. Well, most likely they will look to so-called Christian political leaders, the Christian political element that will claim they can help stabilize the social element because they have considerable influence over the people. So in this scenario, the government would avert a revolt, get stability. That's a good thing for the government, they think. And the conservative Christian element would be given considerable influence and control in government. But realistically, could this happen? How would this happen? In order for this to happen, here especially, more power would have, really still have to reside in the hands of a supportive executive branch of government. Interestingly, in a publication in 2022, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace stated that their analysis of world democracies which fell into authoritarianism showed that it was due to the division of society into mutually distrustful political camps. Extreme polarization. Then the controlling party would enact laws to enact executive orders to favor their particular Christian views, citing national security, here we go again, as their justification to prohibit the promotion of any ideas that they would deem a threat to the stability of the nation. Well, even though the scenario is in the, let's call it, speculation category, it may seem quite impossible to some. We do see, in spite of that, the hybrid of nominal Christianity with state, we do see this already happening, and it's a template set down in Russia that can quickly be translated to Europe or the United States in times of, you know, if the United States thinks they need to enact something like this for national emergency. Well, what is the situation in Russia? What are we talking about here? Well, in Russia in 2002, and then again in 2016, they enacted laws targeting religious groups outside the Russian Orthodox Church. Okay, so they've chosen the Russian Orthodox Church as the national entity that they want. And then these laws were justified as anti-terrorism measures. Okay, laws that if you were another other religion and promoting your other religion, you were a terrorist. Well, President Vladimir Putin was quoted, he was quoted as saying, quote here, the Russian Orthodox Church is part of a bulwark of Russian nationalism, and anything that undermines that concept is a real threat, whether it is evangelical Protestant missionaries or anything else. All those who defy these new laws are faced with large fines and 6 to 10 years in prison. Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists, and so forth, have been labeled as extremists, a, quote, threat to public order and public security, end of quote. Evangelization in any manner is prohibited, including email. And the new laws make it illegal to preach, proselytize, or hand out religious materials outside of the specifically designed places, or to even have religious gatherings in people's homes, terming these as gatherings of extremists. Well, okay, so we think it can't happen here. Well, remember that a House bill was passed in 2001. What was it called? The Patriot Act. You remember that one? And it was because of the Twin Towers attack. And because of that law, freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution, including free speech and the right to fair trial, were essentially dissolved when, quote, terrorism was charged. Well, a pastor really expected this and expected that the general suppression of personal liberties by government and the specific suppression of the brethren, by the nominal church, not by Islam, but by the nominal church in alliance with the state, such as we see in Russia, would only serve to ignite the Lord's great army to the point of the great social explosion described as an earthquake in Revelation 16. I need to clarify that the threat of Islamic terror or Islamic dominance is not what Bible students should be concerned about. Islam is just a player in this scenario, the agent to cause fear that will drive governments to enact stronger controls and to restrict liberty, especially on independent Christian groups like ourselves. But according to the prophetic vision, the restrictions on Christian teachings and on many other social teachings will eventually cause that great army to rise up against their own so-called Christian systems that may be in collusion with the governments at that time. Remember that the pastor stated that the conflict would be irrepressible. This is not going to go away peaceably. The blessing hidden in all of this, is that as man's selfish schemes fail and the common people's eyes are opened and they revolt against the untruths and corruptions, God's plan will reach a climax, finally convincing mankind that they cannot rule themselves with any kind of king or any other kind of government where selfishness rules in men's hearts. The final conclusion of this old order, on earth will be in the same manner as with the world that was of Noah's day. That world, remember, overflowed with literal water to destroy the evil influence on the earth. And we will soon see the culmination of a great deluge of another sort that will overwhelm tyrannical, political, social, financial, and religious institutions of this present time. The shackles of ignorance will be broken and dispelled by the increasing water of truth from our returned Lord, sufficient truth, sufficient light to compel even reasoning minds today to take even violent action to throw off all ignorance. That's an interesting statement that's made there, that even reasoning, calm reasoning minds today will be compelled at some point to take violent action to throw off all injustice. Eventually, under the administration of our Lord and the church, the light from our returned Lord will fill the hearts of all who will desire and appreciate justice and truth. Habakkuk 2:14. For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Well, this is the amen to our lesson. The refuge of lies and evil finally being swept away by the waters of truth. We have spoken about what will happen as the old order on this earth goes down. We have not spoken yet as to our role in all of this. So we should be cautious that all of these chaotic events do not cause fear, which could prompt us to be possibly caught up in the world's struggle. This would be a serious distraction from our real mission as consecrated saints. Remember that Noah, even withstanding ridicule, kept preaching and kept building that ark. Noah had faith in God's words, even though there had never been rain for a long, ever before that time. And the analogy for us now is that even though some predicted events may sound like there's no rain, sound unreasonable to many, we should put our trust in the prophetic illustrations of the Bible and the pastor's predictions rather than the disinformation swirling around from nominal Christianity. Now, a good guide, I think, is that a good guideline to follow is to rule out any prophetic suggestions coming from the nominal churches and internet evangelist. I'm suggesting that what has been come to their minds is most often really just from the great deceiver. From James 1:12 in the English Standard Version. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised. And so may the Lord bless us all in the months and years ahead, that we be not deceived, and that we continue to fortify our faith with the harvest message. Thank you, brethren.